From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Well, I think Jesse Helms is emblematic of what's wrong in this country. He's the archetypical American racist and a symbol of the centrality of racism in U.S. life.
Sally Booker on the retirement of Senator Jesse Helms, along with comments from former now President Patricia Ireland and lesbian activist writer Mab Segrist. Then, new documents and interviews underscore how fully the Clinton administration knew about the genocide in Rwanda and thwarted efforts to stop it. We'll speak with an investigative reporter who just completed a three-year report involving 60 interviews with State Department, Defense Department, and National Security Council officials. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli soldiers killed 7 Palestinians yesterday in an upsurge of violence in the West Bank and Gaza, including an apparent Israeli attempt to kill 2 top Hamas leaders. Israeli helicopters in Gaza fired missiles at cars carrying the leaders, but they escaped unharmed. Killed in the attack was one of the leaders' 21-year-old sons. Meanwhile, 5 Palestinians were killed by Israeli gunfire near the West Bank city of Nablus. In Jerusalem, visiting German Foreign Minister Jaksha Fischer said Mideast truce talks tentatively set for Berlin must be well prepared and that he was in touch with the United States, Russia, and the European Union on the issue. The talks would be held between Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. A kibbutz that markets low-grade chemical weapons is poised to sell millions of dollars worth of riot control equipment to Zimbabwe in a move its critics warn will translate into heightened repression by President Robert Mugabe. According to the firm's website, Beit Alpha Trailer Company builds riot control vehicles and specializes in water cannon technology, chemical additives to be used in restraining dangerous inmate situations in correctional facilities, quote, can be injected in the water stream under further officer control to further restrain and demobilize the inmate. The Beit Alpha Trailer Company general manager says the chemical is a food color that aims at having a psychological effect, but the website suggests other chemicals, such as pepper spray, can be injected into the cannon's water stream. Brazil's health minister has moved to strip Roche Pharmaceuticals' patent on the anti-AIDS drug nalfinavir after negotiations failed to lower the price. He said yesterday he would use a clause in Brazil's 1997 intellectual property law that allows patents to be broken in cases of national emergency or when companies employ abusive pricing policies. The move marks the first time Brazil has stripped the patent on an anti-AIDS medication despite previous threats to do so. Brazil, which has the highest number of people with AIDS in Latin America, distributes a cocktail of anti-AIDS drugs free to anyone who needs it. Last year, some 90,000 people received the drugs that would have cost each of them up to $15,000. In 4 years, the number of AIDS deaths in Brazil has fallen from 11,000 to 4,000. More than 200 activists, civil rights leaders, and celebrities yesterday urged the United Nations to challenge U.S. drug laws in an upcoming U.N. conference on racism, saying they discriminate against African Americans and Latinos. In a petition to U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan, the signatories say the U.S. war on drugs is, quote, not a war on plants and chemicals, but on citizens and other human beings who all too often are members of racial and ethnic minorities. Whites use as many drugs as people of color do, but 80% of those incarcerated are African American or Latino. The petitioners included actor Danny Glover, singer Harry Belafonte, New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, Julian Bond, chair of the NAACP, and dozens of legislators, church leaders, scholars, and scientists. Federal officials have filed a lawsuit in Iowa that accuses 3 former supervisors at an egg farm of raping Mexican women who work there and threatened to fire or kill them if they did not submit. The lawsuit filed on Monday by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says that at least one of the rapes at DeCoster Farms occurred at knife point. No criminal charges have been filed against the supervisors. A lawyer for the company said 2 of the supervisors were fired after being accused of taking bribes from job applicants. The 3rd supervisor left earlier. And two Marine instructors from the Quantico Marine Corps base in Virginia have been charged with raping trainees at a military base in Missouri. If convicted of rape, they could be sentenced to life in prison. The two were already facing charges that included sexual harassment and inappropriate sexual relations. A cancer patient who won a $3 billion jury award against the tobacco company Philip Morris has agreed to accept a reduced award of $100 million. Earlier this month, a Los Angeles Superior Court judge upheld the jury's verdict but ruled that the award to the plaintiff, Richard Boken, was excessive. He gave Boken until Friday to accept the lesser amount. Otherwise, the judge says there would be a new trial to reconsider punitive damages. A lawyer for Philip Morris says the company would still appeal the award as excessive. A North Carolina state legislator apologized for forwarding to fellow lawmakers an email message that said two things made this country great: white men and Christianity. The lawmaker, Representative Donald Davis, a white Republican, said he received the letter on Friday and forwarded it to every member of the state House and Senate. He said he did not consider the letter racist. Before releasing the apology, Davis had said of the email message, quote, "There's a lot of it that's truth, the way I see it. Who came to this country first? The white man, didn't he? That's who made this country great." Every Breath You Take, The Police, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. We went to alternet.org this morning, and they're highlighting a piece announcing retirement. Helms deserves scrutiny, not praise, by Thomas Tully of Spectator magazine. He writes, Jesse Helms has been the source of some of the worst invective spewed in Congress since the abolition of slavery. He remains, even as he approaches his 80th year on Earth and his 30th year in the U.S. Senate, an unrepentant demagogue, buoyed by decades by playing upon the worst prejudices of his fellow Americans. You wouldn't know this, though, by the majority of media coverage given to Senator Noe's much ballyhooed announcement that he would not seek a sixth term in 2002. Bland summaries of his political career have instead focused on him as an old-school conservative icon or Cold War soldier who never gave up the Reagan-esque faith. The coverage has invariably included references to Helms' mounting physical infirmities. He therefore comes across, especially on TV, as very vulnerable, a put-upon old man deserving of sympathy instead of critique. Today on Democracy Now!, we'll take a different approach. We're joined on the telephone by Patricia Ireland, who's the former president of the National Organization for Women, and Mab Segrest, who organized against racism and homophobia in North Carolina for the past 20 years. Her book, Memoirs of a Race Traitor, named an outstanding book on human rights in North America, reflects her experiences organizing against neo-Nazi movements and hate violence. And she served as founding director of North Carolinians Against Racist and Religious Violence for 7 years, currently finishing a book on globalization. Mab Segrest joins us from Benson, North Carolina. Can you start off by giving your reaction to Jesse Helms' announcement?
more relief and sadness, I think, than celebration. Very glad that this long reign of hate will soon be over, but sad at the devastation that this man has left in his wake.
Can you talk about his record? What stands out for you?
Well, I was reflecting some on it last night, listening to the glowing tributes on the television, and it seems like for the past 30 years he's really reflected, organized, and articulated the worst in American politics. And he was elected to the Senate in 72, but it really goes back much earlier than that. In the 50s, he was instrumental in Will Smith's virulent Senate campaign against Frank Porter Graham and ended up as the senator's staff person in Congress, was there for the McCarthy period, I assume, came home, developed a public reputation with the most racist diatribes on a local television station, got elected to the Senate in opposition to African-American struggles for freedom, anti-communism, very soon added to his quiver the panoply of social issues that the new right was developing in the early 70s, as they rapidly figured that there's only so many people you could get to vote for making rich people richer, and they needed a populist base, so they went to abortion, prayer in the schools, homosexuality. He was a very early warrior in the culture wars. When the 80s came along, he was in strident opposition to liberation movements in Latin America and in support of Darbasan and the most fascist regimes there and all over the world. The IBM Treaty, Boy Scouts, more recently Helms Burton, resurrecting Cold War missile defense systems. I mean, the man has been on the wrong side of more issues than almost anybody else in this country.
Well, what accounts for his support in North Carolina?
Well, I think that one thing that some people don't realize outside of the state is that his margin of support in North Carolina for years has been very narrow. You start off an election, 45% of people hate him, 45% of people are going to love him, and it'll get down to a swing vote of 3 or 4%, and we've never really been able to get that swing vote to swing, and partly because the man is like no holds barred. I mean, he speaks about God and country and family, but he knows you get power any way you can and you keep it any way you can, and the kind of scurrilous tactics he's used over the years have set increasingly new lows for American politics.
We're also joined on the phone by Patricia Ireland, former president of the National Organization for Women, as we talk about the announced retirement of North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms. Patricia Ireland, he is well known for the Helms Amendment that prevented any U.S. international family planning money from funding abortions. Since the U.N. adopted the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women in 1979, Helms has consistently refused to hold hearings on it. The U.S. is the only industrialized country that has yet to ratify this convention. Your response to his career and what his retirement will mean?
Well, I think Mab's covered a lot of it. He had shown an extreme arrogance and an ultra-nationalism in foreign policy. He was, I guess, a refugee from the used-to-be in terms of being a cold warrior. My concern, in part, is coming out of your newscast and listening to a state legislator today, sending an email saying that the two things that made our country great are white men and Christianity, and then jumping from there to say that there is some truth in that, as he alleged that who first came to this country, after all, were white men, as if the country had been a vacuum until then. My concern, in part, is that we will end up with a Helms clone in the Senate, only this time the clone will be young and vigorous. At 80, there was a certain limit after he was no longer chair of the Helms of the Foreign Affairs Committee. There was a certain limit to what Helms was able to do or had the energy to do. I was reminded, listening yesterday to some of the praise for Helms, of Nixon's funeral, where I found myself, as often I do, talking back to the television. It was suddenly as if he had been this paragon of virtue, and it just kind of blew me away.
There's medication for problems like that, talking to television sets. But Elizabeth Dole, former presidential candidate, two-time cabinet secretary, has been talked about as a serious consideration for Helms' seat. What do you think of that?
I think it's going to be ironic if we ended up with two women candidates, because Elizabeth Dole is certainly being talked about on the Republican side, and we have Elaine Marshall talked about on the Democratic side. She has won statewide office before, although nationally she's certainly not as well known as Elizabeth Dole. But there's going to be a lot of competition for the nominations. That seat's been tied up for a long time, and on the one hand, we couldn't do worse than Jesse Helms, and on the other hand, I think Elizabeth Dole comes wrapped in a certain saccharine coating that masks some of her extremist views, and she's also shown herself willing to mold her views, as she did to be part of the Reagan administration. Her views moved to the right at that time, so I certainly don't trust her.
Let me go back to Mab Segres for a minute. You have, in terms of foreign policy, you're writing a book on globalization. The U.S. has very much isolated Cuba, and the Helms-Burton Act is well known in relation to Cuba. What about Jesse Helms and our neighbor to the south?
Well, I'm sure the Cubans are celebrating today. I mean, Jesse couldn't do it, though, by himself, of course, but he certainly, that embargo has caused a huge amount of pain and suffering for the people of Cuba, and just as his regressive foreign policy has in many places. So, you know, I think that it's also dangerous to view him as kind of a dinosaur or a throwback, because, as you point out, there are other folks who are coming in his place. There's, like, this compassionate conservative thing, which he never did, never wanted to do. It's not his caste, but all of those politics are certainly around, and in the Bush administration getting recast rapidly in the absence of a communist threat, we still can worry about it and shape our policy around it. So,
right now, what are your plans for the seat? A lot of people will be starting to come forward. What about grassroots organizing and whether you're going to be focusing on electoral politics? Do you see this as a real opportunity?
Well, I'd like to make clear that I'm not running. But really strong grassroots campaigns around Harvey Gantt's candidacy. Elaine Marshall was the main declared candidate now, and all those folks who got activated against Helms, I mean, that's been the good part of his legacy here, and I think other places too. He was so bad on so many things, articulating the links so clearly, that people saw their need to work together and figure out another way to explain all of that. And there is that left in North Carolina, and I hope that there will be those grassroots components. I hope that the party and the candidates honor them and call on them, which hasn't always been the case.
We just heard Patricia Ireland refer to this news piece, the state legislator Donald Davis, a white Republican who sent around this email, "Two things made this country great, white men and Christianity." Who is he?
You know, I'm not even sure. He's one of the legislators. He's part of the problem.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We've been joined by Mab Segres, who currently is writing a book on globalization, but is founding director of North Carolinians Against Racist and Religious Violence. And Patricia Ireland, former president of the National Organization for Women. What are you doing now?
I'm here in Miami, actually, and I'm doing consulting work in Washington. But I, of course, wanted to note that we just lost the Latin Grammys because of the Cuban protests here, so there's certainly strong emotions around that embargo still to this day.
Well, thank you very much both for being with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to get response from Sally Booker about Jesse Helms and foreign policy, particularly as it relates to Africa. He'll also be talking about a new statement that they've just released on the UN Conference on Racism, and we'll be covering that conference in Durban extensively. And then we're going to go to the latest expose on the U.S. role in the Rwandan genocide. You're listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. Stay with us.
from each other. That's what love is for. Don't you let
nobody drag your spirit down.
Tie your spirit
let
down. Nobody tear your spirit down.
Let nobody drag your spirit down. Let nobody drag your spirit down.
Don't you
let nobody drag your spirit down.
Don't you
let nobody drag your spirit down.
Don't you
let nobody drag your spirit down.
Yeah. Can I say it?
Wilson Pickett, don't you ever let nobody drag your spirit down, from Say Yo Business, a live recording by Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. And a special good morning to KZYX and Z, who are running us live today, as well as WEOS in Geneva, New York, and WMNF in Tampa. A special hello to KPFA listeners in Berkeley, as well as KGNU listeners in Boulder, Denver, and so many other stations around the country, and to you listening at WBIX.org. It's great to be with you, and let your friends know it'll be running throughout the day on that address. Well, we're going to talk right now for a few minutes about Jesse Helms and his record on Africa, and then go to the UN Conference on Racism for a minute, and then the latest on new documents out on the U.S. role in the genocide in Rwanda. Well, as we were just saying, Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina last night announced that he will be retiring when his term expires in a year from the U.S. Senate. He is well known as Senator No for stalling legislation and appointments until he won his way, from opposing a national holiday in honor of Martin Luther King to supporting apartheid in South Africa to restructuring United Nations finances to reduce the United States dues. Helms aggressively pushed a right-wing agenda in U.S. policy. He championed a strong military establishment, prayer in the public schools, while opposing affirmative action, gay rights, gun control, abortion, and government support of the arts. We're joined right now by Sally Booker. And Sally Booker has recently come to head up Africa Action, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy, for having me on.
It's good to have you with us. Why don't you start off by your comments on the man who ran the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for so long?
Well, I think Jesse Helms is emblematic of what's wrong in this country. He's the archetypical American racist and a symbol of the centrality of racism in U.S. life and U.S. public policy, both domestically and foreign policy. On the domestic side, for many people, he's the equivalent of a war criminal of the U.S. civil rights conflicts. On the foreign policy side, he was a friend and defender of apartheid South Africa, racist Rhodesia under the rule of Ian Smith, and he was a friend of America's Cold War allies in Africa, like Mobutu Sese Seko, Jonas Savimbi, Gacha Buthelezi. And he was also a devout, if you will, enemy of the notion of the U.S. providing development assistance. He wanted to see the end of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and he was obviously always a principal foe of U.S. contributions to the United Nations and to any concept that the United States shared some global responsibilities in the world. So we applaud the fact that he's leaving. I find it unfortunate that it wasn't through the ballot box. But at the same time that he's departing, what he represents is alive and thriving in the Senate and in the U.S. government.
Yesterday, you put out a statement on the UN Conference Against Racism that's going to be taking place in Durban, South Africa, and I want to encourage everyone to listen to Democracy Now! During that week. We'll be doing daily specials. Can you talk about the position of your organization?
Well, yes. We're trying to address the World Conference Against Racism essentially on 4 points. We're seeking a declaration that the slave trade and enslavement of Africans were crimes against humanity. Two, that there's a right to reparations for slavery, colonialism, apartheid, and continuing racism. And these two first points relate to the need to address the foundations of today's global inequalities. The latter two points are, we're pressing for the cancellation of African countries' external debts as a sort of down payment on reparations, and also because it really raises the question of who owes what to whom. And finally, our fourth point is that we're trying to press for the full financing of the Global Fund for AIDS and other infectious diseases. The latter two points address, you know, the immediate steps that can and must be taken at the level of international policy to save millions of African lives. And we believe very strongly, and we charge that AIDS, the global AIDS pandemic, in fact, is a matter of international racism, and that's the devaluation of black life that has led to the West and the rich countries' failure to finance what, in fact, could be the defeat of this pandemic.
What do you make of, hasn't at this point, as we move closer to the World Conference Against Racism, the U.S. succeeding in getting reparations taken off the agenda and replaced with some kind of a discussion of an apology?
Right. Well, the United States' behavior in the two-year process leading up to this conference, thus meaning during the Clinton administration years as well, itself was very sort of Jesse Helms-ish. It was the United States throwing its weight around and trying to censor what would be discussed at this World Conference Against Racism. They feel they have succeeded in perhaps limiting the language on reparations, but we're certain that at the NGO forum that precedes the official conference and at the official conference itself, actually the issue of reparations is going to be the central issue, the most important issue. The United States threatened to boycott the conference altogether. They indicated yesterday that they'll send a delegation, probably a low-level delegation, in an effort to try and undermine the significance of the conference. But we think the conference is, in many ways, already a success. And precisely those things the U.S. government has been trying to censor are going to be the main focus of this conference. And the conference represents an expansion of the international movement for racial justice and an integration, if you will, of that movement with the larger movement against global apartheid, what's often called the anti-globalization movement.
We're talking to Sally Booker, who is head of Africa Action, which incorporates the American Committee on Africa, the Africa Fund, and the Africa Policy Information Center, one of the oldest organizations devoted to analysis and advocacy of African affairs. We're going to turn now with Sally Booker, as well as our next guest, Samantha Power, to the issue of Rwanda and the latest information on it. Samantha Power has written the Atlantic Monthly September 2001 piece called Bystanders to Genocide. It starts, in the course of 100 days in 1994, the Hutu government of Rwanda and its extremist allies very nearly succeeded in exterminating the country's Tutsi minority. Using firearms, machetes, and a variety of garden implements, Hutu militiamen, soldiers, and ordinary citizens murdered some 800,000 Tutsi and politically moderate Hutu. It was the fastest, most efficient killing spree of the 20th century. A few years later, in a series in The New Yorker, Philip Gurevich recounted in horrific detail the story of the genocide and the world's failure to stop it. President Bill Clinton, a famously avid reader, expressed shock. He sent copies of Gurevich's articles to his second-term National Security Advisor, Sandy Berger. The articles bore confused, angry, searching queries in the margins. Is what he's saying true? Clinton wrote with a thick black felt-tip pen beside the heavily underlined paragraphs. How did this happen? He asked, adding, I want to get to the bottom of this. The president's urgency and outrage were oddly timed. As the terror in Rwanda unfolded, Clinton had shown virtually no interest in stopping the genocide, and his administration had stood by as the death toll rose into the hundreds of thousands. Why did the United States not do more for the Rwandans at the time of the killings? Did the president really not know about the genocide, as his marginalia suggested? Who were the people in his administration who made the life and death decisions that dictated U.S. policy? Why did they decide or decide not to decide as they did? Were any voices inside or outside the U.S. government demanding that the United States do more? If so, why weren't they heeded? And most crucial, what could the U.S. have done to save lives? We turn now to Samantha Power, who is Executive Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, who has spent years investigating the Rwandan genocide. Welcome to Democracy.
Many thanks. Good to be here.
Well, tell us your latest findings on how the genocide took place specifically in relation to U.S. policy.
Well, I think what's most striking about the fruits, if you want to call them that, of the three-year investigation that I did with the National Security Archive in Washington is not just that the United States didn't send its own troops to Rwanda, which I think we all remember from 1994, that we stayed home. It was after Somalia, and there was no appetite for getting back involved militarily in Africa. What's most striking, I think, though, is that we did nothing along the continuum of intervention. There were all kinds of things that the United States might have done, from condemning at a high level for having President Clinton go on the airwaves and denounce the Rwandan government, which was committing the genocide, responsible for killing 8,000 Rwandans per day. The United States could have used its assets, its military technical assets, to jam Rwandan hate radio, which was being used both to propagate the hate and to stir people up, but also, perhaps more crucially, to broadcast the names, addresses, and even license plate numbers of potential Tutsi victims. The United States could have asked that the Rwandan ambassador in New York to the United Nations be expelled. It could have walked out of meetings with the Rwandan government, again, in order to protest the killings. It could have threatened to prosecute those who were participating in the killings. And perhaps most significantly, it could have led the world. It could have galvanized an international response to the genocide. It could have sent UN reinforcements, or it could have ensured that UN reinforcements were sent to the beleaguered UN mission in Rwanda. Instead, what it did was, again, not send its own troops, not do any of the things I've mentioned so far, and at the United Nations insist on the withdrawal of the UN mission that was based in Kigali when the genocide began. So first it insisted on the withdrawal, then it spent the next 2 months blocking the deployment of reinforcements. And so what happened was a UN mission of 2,500 troops was slashed to 500, and then for 2 months the United States blocked at the Security Council the beef-up of that presence to the desired 5,000, and the UN commander in Rwanda was really left to just fend for himself.
Warren Christopher, the Secretary of State at the time, Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. What's each of their justifications? A part of the power of your piece is the extensive interviews that you did over this three-year period.
Well, I think in the case of Warren Christopher, who was one of the few senior U.S. officials that refused to speak with me, his defense would be, in effect, I don't do Africa. But, of course, that's not a defense. That's the problem. He really paid very little attention to the genocide as it was unfolding. He was busy doing other things. And the response that was formulated, and again, there wasn't much of a response, but to the extent that a response was formulated, it was formulated by mid-level officials. Christopher had a way, even ahead of the genocide, of delegating all things related to Africa to his so-called Africa specialist within the State Department. When the genocide began in Rwanda, no exception was made. He busied himself with events related to North Korea and to Bosnia and to Haiti and to other things that were going on at the time, and left the formulation again of U.S. policy in the Rwanda sphere to much more junior officials. In the case of Madeleine Albright, it's a little more complex. Albright at the time was a strong crusader for intervention in Bosnia, an unsuccessful crusader, I might add. She was doing all she could to try to get the administration to intervene on behalf of the beleaguered Bosnian Muslims, who were also subject to systematic persecution and killing. And I think to an extent, she chose her battles. I think she had no expectation that she could bring the Clinton administration around to intervene in Africa. The land of the possible, I think she had confined so narrowly, and this isn't true just of her, this is true of many people who one might have expected to respond differently to Rwanda. And the sum total of this shrunken land of the possible, which is, you know, often an accompaniment of advocacy in relation to Africa, of course, but was that you did not have a strong lobby within the U.S. government, even among the humanitarians and the humanitarian hawks, you might call them, for U.S. intervention, but even for high-level attention to this question. It was as if everybody sort of looked left, looked right, sort of said, yeah, this is, you know, so soon after Somalia, the Congress is breathing down our necks, they don't even want to do peacekeeping in Europe, never mind in Africa, we'll never get through the kinds of things that would be required to stop the genocide entirely, therefore, maybe we'll just focus on other things. And that, I think, is what Albright did.
Samantha Power is our guest. Her very powerful piece in the September issue of the Atlantic Monthly, Bystanders to Genocide. It's very, very hard to read your piece. And, I mean, some of this has come out over the last few years, right back to when it was actually happening, the genocide in Rwanda. But the fury going through this piece is we read you talking about, for example, against this backdrop and under the leadership of Anthony Lake, the National Security Advisor, the Clinton administration accelerated the development of a formal U.S. Peacekeeping doctrine. And you talk about how there was never a high-level meeting called around the issue as it was taking place of the genocide in Rwanda. Never did people get together to really lay out a program, and the opposite approach seemed to prevail. As more people died, we have to remove ourselves even further, going right up to President Clinton, or what was President Clinton's role?
I think you've really pointed to perhaps the most shocking finding, and it's such a banality that I'm surprised to be calling it the most shocking finding. But the fact that 800,000 people could die in 100 days, 8,000 people a day on average, and that it would never warrant a principals committee meeting, a meeting of the president and his senior advisors on this subject, is truly unbelievable. And again, it's the product of some bureaucratic forces, basically, with U.S. troops taken off the table or never put on the table early on, and the range of options that I've already mentioned being debated. The feeling was, look, when it comes to radio jamming, you know, threatening of prosecution, sort of diplomatic measures, humanitarian aid, these kinds of things, the feeling was, could be settled and could be tended to at the mid-level. The problem was that without high-level ownership of this issue, the path of most resistance was going to become the path of least resistance. And by that I mean any agency or even any individual within strong-willed individual within one of the departments or one of the agencies in the U.S. government was capable of blocking simply by fault-finding, by saying, oh, that won't do any good, or it'll be too expensive, or it'll be too risky, but was capable of blocking these other options that were mentioned. And the Pentagon fear, especially, and I think this has to be said, was that if you dip a toe in, your whole body will eventually end up submerged. So they were saying, you know, okay, well, you over at the State Department, you Africa specialists, okay, you may say that all you want us to do is jam hate radio, but we know that if, you know, we deploy command solo or blocking or jamming equipment over Rwandan airspace and that plane gets, you know, shot at, we're going to get dragged in. You may say that you only want to send UN peacekeepers from other countries to Rwanda to aid in suppressing the genocide, but we know when those peacekeepers get into trouble, we're going to be the ones called to bail them out. And so there was this deep, deep suspicion, in part also because there was a feeling at the Pentagon that Clinton had abandoned them after they got into trouble in Rwanda. You know, I interviewed a number of people who said, you know, the only thing worse than 18 Rangers dying in that Somalia firefight in October of 1993, 6 months ahead of the genocide in Rwanda, was the president going on national television within 24 hours and saying that the U.S. troops were coming home. You know, there's a real sense of, you know, if we get into trouble, especially when it's for humanitarian purposes, especially if it's in Africa, where there's no strong lobby, you know, at home for maintaining support there, you know, we're gonna be the ones to pay the price. Clinton will bail.
Now let's talk about the G word, genocide, and how the administration dealt with this, which perhaps is clearly what implicates them the most, and how carefully crafted and orchestrated it was not to use that word to trigger international treaties and response.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things that are most striking about the wiggle campaign that went on really from late April up until, mid-June. One is the fact that the word was even being debated indicates how well known the scale of the atrocities was, within the U.S. government. I mean, the fact that Warren Christopher was saying don't use the word genocide means, and that it was a hard decision, that is, that people were going back and forth and he was getting memos in both directions, means that, we knew that something nearly genocidal, if not totally genocidal, was underway from 2 weeks in. And that's an early knowledge. Second, of course, once it's become a foolproof genocide, which I think is obvious by the third week in April, so again, 2 weeks into the genocide or 3 weeks into the genocide, there was this decision, as you say, not to use the G word. So it was past the point of debate. Everybody knew, what was going on the ground and that all Tutsi were vulnerable. And the decision was made. You mentioned the international obligations. There was a fear of triggering the 1948 Genocide Convention, which obliged signatories to prevent and punish genocide. But I think the greater fear was the fear of moral dissonance and political pressure. The fear was that if you call what was going on in Rwanda a genocide, that there had to be a stop it, and the stop it had to be accompanied by U.S. threats to do something. And so given that the administration had already decided that it wasn't going to do anything robust about, what was going on in Rwanda, then the feeling was, why should we generate a spike in public interest and in public pressure and political pressure by calling a spade a spade? In other words, if it would be one thing if we were still debating what to do, then, call it for what it is. But we knew already, we knew from day one that in light of public appetite for, peacekeeping and for Africa deployments in particular, we weren't going there. And so given that we weren't going there, why would we want people to think that what was going on was a genocide? Never mind the fact that we knew it was a genocide, and that might be one reason that other people might be interested as well. I mean, it really is a deplorable spin campaign, one of the great spin campaigns of the century.
We're talking to Samantha Power. Her piece in the Atlantic Monthly is out for September, and she heads the Carr Center for Human Rights at the Kennedy School of Government. Bystanders to Genocide is the piece. We're going to come back with her and also get response from Sally Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action, after this break here on Democracy Now!
On the darker side of life, living with a stigma, a 6-6 stigma, stigmas that killing prosperity. I have a remedy.
What?
A mix of remedy.
What kind of remedy?
A simple remedy. So tell me,
just listen, 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 just listen, 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 just listen, listen.
All are we is one,
all are we is one,
all are we is one,
all are we is one.
So if you're a human being, this one is for you. From the most recessive to the dominant. All are you.
Listen well.
Till We Do Something About It by Sam Archer. His CD, The Return, here on Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. We're talking about Rwanda, bystanders to genocide. Clearly, racism kills, as we see a policy of the United States during the 100 days in 1994 when the genocide in Rwanda took place. Samantha Power is our guest. Her piece in the Atlantic Monthly, September, Bystanders to Genocide. There's a part of your piece where you talk about what the U.S. government was saying when asked questions by reporters. And you talk about a press conference that was held, one of the many press briefings, when one reporter did question what was taking place at a State Department press conference. Well, maybe I'll go back even a little further than that. You talk about Prue Bushnell, and you say at a State Department press conference on April 8th, Bushnell made an appearance and spoke gravely about the mounting violence in Rwanda and the status of Americans there. After she left the podium, Michael McCurry, the department spokesman, took her place and criticized foreign governments for preventing the screening of the Steven Spielberg film Schindler's List. He said this film movingly portrays the 20th century's most horrible catastrophe, and it shows that even in the midst of genocide, one individual can make a difference. No one made any connection between Bushnell's remarks and McCurry's. Neither journalists nor officials in the United States were focused on the Tutsi. And then you go on and talk about how when a reporter questioned the State Department about the word genocide, about the fact that they were saying acts of genocide. And finally, the reporter asked Christine Shelley, the State Department spokesperson, how many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
That's right. I don't know that she had an answer for that. Christine Shelley became the kind of poster child, poster woman for the U.S. policy at the time and for this transparent spin campaign. I mean, all other governments had long been using the word at that point, and the NGOs had been calling for use of the word for already 1 month by the time of that press conference. But Christine Shelley had her orders, and the orders were so convoluted that she went up there and yammered endlessly. I mean, I think it was 6 or 7 minutes, you know, saying, well, certain acts on the ground might conceivably, under the terms of Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, be, you know, in the eyes of certain... That sort of, you know, multisyllabic, basically stalling. And then finally, you know, as you say, this reporter just kind of cuts through it all and says, okay, you've talked a lot about acts of genocide. You know, how many acts of genocide does it take to make a genocide? But, you know, in fairness, I mean, Christine Shelley is rolled out by an administration that doesn't want to do something. I mean, I think what's most, again, really, really striking about this and important to keep in mind is that this ranked so low on the list of priorities that Christine Shelley, in effect, you know, was before the State Department press corps winging it. I mean, she had her orders not to use the word genocide, but, you know, apart from that, she was kind of free to wander off in whatever direction she wanted to. I mean, it just, this was an issue that wasn't being owned by Warren Christopher, again, except in a kind of prevent-defense kind of way, except in an obstructionist way.
So what about...
Don't let UN troops go there because we'll have to rescue them, and don't use the G word.
What about David Rawson, the U.S. ambassador to Rwanda? Explain what happened to him, how first where he was when the Rwandan president died and when the massacres began, and what he did.
Well, David was an unusual ambassador for Africa, or in fact for much of the developing world, in that he actually spoke the local language fluently. He spoke Kinyarwanda. He'd grown up the son of a missionary father in neighboring Burundi, and in some ways you wouldn't have wanted anybody else at the, you know, at the scene of the crime but Ambassador Rawson. I mean, he really knew the country and loved the country and its people. But I'm not sure that, in fact, his intimacy with the country was a help. It may have been something of a hindrance because he got to know people so well that I think he also came to trust them unduly, and he became deeply invested in the peace process ahead of the plane crash that became the catalyst for the genocide. When the plane went down and the killings began, he was in his residence with his wife watching a tape broadcast of MacNeil Lehrer. He heard the two explosions, and his wife said, you know, that's not ordinary gunfire. You know, that sounds like something different. He immediately became his residence became a sort of receptacle for people, Rwandans in the neighborhood, who were looking for shelter. I mean, they assumed that if they gathered with the American ambassador or at any kind of international, base or institution, that they would be safe. And indeed, it looked like they might be for the first 2 days. But then on April 7th, in the evening of April 7th, the day after the plane crash, the United States made the decision to evacuate all of its foreign nationals. And 2 days later, then on April 9th, the evacuation began, and these 300 Rwandans who'd gathered at the ambassador's residence were left to fend for themselves. This happened throughout Rwanda. It wasn't just an American phenomenon. I mean, many of the Europeans did the same, leaving their Rwandans to their own, to their own devices, to their own suffering. It also happened at a number of the UN installations where Rwandans especially had gathered, thinking that, look, this is these are UN peacekeepers. They're here to protect us. That, again, was a misguided assumption. Rawson evacuated with the American nationals, missionaries, and embassy personnel, and 35 members of his staff, of his U.S. embassy staff, Rwandans. The 35 Rwandans who had served the U.S. government were murdered in the genocide.
And you describe how, in fact, the UN peacekeepers, where they were, definitely did protect people that they were with. I mean, in a stadium where there were hundreds of people and in other places. And when the UN peacekeeping force was pulled out, how it left all these people to die. We know it well from Timor. When the UN was there, 1,000 Timorese were fleeing the Indonesian military violence supported by the U.S. And the UN started to pull out, and there was a tremendous outcry because everyone knew that the Timorese there would probably be slaughtered. In Rwanda, we saw the same thing. And yet, in the end, the U.S. in particular at the United Nations forced the U.N. peacekeepers to pull out. What about the role, and we just have a minute on this, of the head of the U.N. peacekeeping force and what message he was putting out, the Canadian peacekeeper?
Yes, that's Romeo Dallaire. As I write in the piece, the man who did the most for Rwandans feels the worst. Dallaire had the unfortunate privilege of being on the ground and being the one tasked, in his own mind anyway, to protect Rwandans. He had the to suffer the indignity of seeing 2,000 of his troops pulled out from beneath him. He was left with a rump mission of 500. He had the indignity of seeing crisply dressed foreign soldiers and shiny new equipment and heavy arms come in to rescue foreign nationals, and then to see those same soldiers and planes depart soon thereafter, though they knew that 20,000 people had already been killed in the capital alone. Dallaire is living now with the guilt of his role in all of this, but he pleaded from just about day one for reinforcements. He said, give me the means and I can do more. He did his best, as you say, to deploy his peacekeepers around town, knowing that just the mere presence of a foreigner could, in fact, mean protection for Rwandans. It didn't always, but, you know, his view was it's worth trying. But alas, that was not the view of people in Western capitals, and very little effort was made. No peacekeepers were sent to reinforce him for the entire duration of the genocide, and he was really left to wing it, and he was unable to wing it to any large success. He did probably manage with his small unit to rescue or to save some 25,000 Rwandans, and we can only imagine how many he might have been able to rescue if he'd received some political support from the West.
You know, when we go back to President Clinton, you tell this very damning story, not even a sideshow, about how he had met a Rwandan human rights activist, Monique Mujawamaria, I don't know if I pronounced her last name right, with Alison DeForge, one of the leading experts on Rwanda, and had met her before the genocide. And it seemed to be because he had met her, and it shows the power with grassroots activists of getting these officials to actually meet human beings, that he maybe understood the genocide more than anything else through the fact that she was missing. And you talk about his obsession in making and seeing, you know, was she dead? Was she alive? And as soon as it was reported in detail in the Washington Post and the New York Times that, in fact, she had managed to talk her way out, had hidden the rafters in her home, gotten out of the country, as soon as he learned that she was okay, you wrote, the president apparently lost his personal interest in events in Rwanda.
Yeah, this is a shocking story. I think it's also a blow to those of us in journalism or in advocacy of any kind. I think that we live our lives predicated on the fiction that if we can just tell the story of one individual on the ground in a country, one victim, one person suffering oppression, that people will see that part, that small person, and have them stand for the larger whole. What the lesson of the Monique adventure for President Clinton, I think, and for the rest of us, is that sometimes, alas, tending to the part, remedying the problem for the part, for the individual, becomes a policy substitute for remedying the whole. And, I mean, it's a sort of, you know, travesty in a way that here was Monique. I mean, she was one Rwandan citizen, and thank God she was rescued. I mean, she's an incredibly valuable, you know, world citizen. But instead of Clinton seeing that if he knew just one person, how, you know, and asking himself, or instead of the rest of us doing the same, you know, if we know just one person, how many hundreds of thousands of others like them are out there vulnerable who don't have people pulling for them? Instead of that happening, instead, the whole bureaucracy became, tailored toward rescuing Monique, saving Monique. I mean, it just shows you what can happen when the president pays attention, you know, in a crisis like this. I mean, everybody was mobilized and exercised. And yet, as you say, you know, when Monique was rescued and was found and actually made her way to Washington, you know, it was as if he forgot, or obviously didn't care much, that there were all these other Rwandans left similarly situated, and again, without the kind of clout that she had had. But I think it really is a lesson, because I think all of our imaginations are limited. And often what we do is we latch on to the one thing we can do, you know, the little thing we can do. And I think that's really important, to just remember that what we're doing is a little thing. A little thing is very important. But then once we've done the little thing, we need to do more little things. And if we're the president, we need to do big things.
Well, Samantha Power, I want to thank you for documenting this, Bystanders to Genocide, in the Atlantic Monthly of this September. Samantha Power, head of the Carr Center for Human Rights at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Special thanks to Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Thank you to Pacifica Station, KPFA in particular today. Sister and brother workers, you make the difference. And to our Pacifica affiliates, yes, we are Pacifica. Today we're broadcasting from downtown community television, DCTV, in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown. In the middle of a firestorm, it's great to be in a firehouse. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of You, Our Listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!